From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, the World Bank will vote on the construction of the Chad-Cameroon pipeline. We'll have a debate. Clinton fumes over the German chancellor's gift of Cuban cigars. We'll look at the links between the CIA and Germany's neo-Nazi movement. Ex-dictator Augusto Pinochet is stripped of his immunity in Chile. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Calling the practice abhorrent, Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan signed a bill yesterday outlawing racial profiling by police. The legislation requires local and state police agencies to track whether officers are deliberately targeting members of certain racial groups. Missouri is the fifth state to pass racial profiling legislation. About 15 other states have considered it. Former President Gerald Ford encouraged George Bush to consider an abortion rights supporter as his running mate, saying such a choice could be the difference between winning and losing a close race. Bush is opposed to abortion. He's declined requests from some conservative leaders to promise to pick an anti-abortion running mate. U.S. and Turkish agents were questioning an Iranian defector who claims to have evidence that Tehran planned and financed the bombings of Pan Am Flight 103 and a U.S. military barracks in Saudi Arabia. The defector, who identified himself as Ahmed Babahani, told the CBS News program 60 Minutes he was a senior intelligence official and has documents to prove his claim that Iran was behind the bombings. Iran has not issued an official response. Two Libyans are on trial for the 1988 airliner bombing, which killed 270 people, most of them Americans. Goya Foods, the nation's largest Hispanic-owned food company, engaged in a ruthless campaign to thwart its workers' union. This, according to the National Labor Relations Board. As the NLRB's case against Goya's division in Florida got underway, the board's lawyers charged that the company has committed more than 40 counts of labor law violations, including failing to bargain with the Union of Needle Trades, Industrial and Textile Employees, known as UNITE. The government said Goya threatened a loss of pension or benefits for workers who support the union and interrogated employees about union activities. The NLRB also wants Goya to reinstate four employees it fired last summer after the workers reported rat droppings in a Goya warehouse and a rat's nest in a Goya carton at a supermarket. The family-owned company, which is based in Secaucus, New Jersey, and sells more than 1,000 products under the Goya, Kirby, Nacelle, and Diana brands, says the conditions were never as bad as portrayed and have been cleaned up. Domino's doesn't have to deliver everywhere, but it can limit deliver areas only if it has a legitimate fear for its driver's safety. That's the essence of an agreement between the pizza chain and the Justice Department to settle a complaint that it discriminates against African Americans by setting geographic limits on where it'll deliver. Domino's says it sold 360 million pizzas last year and is the world's largest pizza delivery company. The new policy provides specific guidelines on when and how store managers can restrict delivery. Delivery can only be limited if there is evidence that crime in the area is a threat to Domino's drivers. Seven people were killed in Cambodia's rugged northwest when their tractor ran over a landmine. Cambodia is one of the most mine-infested countries in the world, with up to 6 million of the hidden killers still buried almost all over the country. About 40,000 Cambodians have lost limbs to mines and unexploded ordnance that are a legacy of nearly three decades of conflict. Investigators reportedly have found a memo that says the U.S. Army asked the Air Force to fire on civilians in the early days of the Korean War. CBS reports the document shows the Army requested U.S. warplanes to strafe columns of South Korean refugees approaching American lines. The memo appears to support the contention that the U.S. adopted a policy of deliberately firing on civilians in the opening weeks of the conflict when U.S. forces were in retreat. The Army's investigation began after the Associated press quoted U.S. veterans and South Korean survivors as saying American GIs carried out a mass killing of civilians in July 1950 at the hamlet of No Gun Ri. As we reported on Democracy Now! Last week, several civic organizations in Korea and here are investigating several dozens of claims that the U.S. Army massacred Koreans beginning in 1947. This year's U.S. Senate race in New Jersey is already one for the history books. After spending a record $33 million on his own campaign, retired Wall Street financier John Corzine watched today to see if it's enough to win him the Democratic nomination. Five other states also are holding primaries today, including an Alabama race in which a judge known for displaying the Ten Commandments in his courtroom is seeking a state Supreme Court seat. Montana voters are choosing from five candidates hoping to replace the retiring governor. Also, primary races in Iowa, South Dakota, and New Mexico. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The World Bank Board of Executive Directors votes today on whether to provide $365 million in taxpayer-financed loans to a consortium led by ExxonMobil and Chevron for a massive oil and pipeline project in the African countries of Chad and Cameroon. Activists say the project threatens to exacerbate government corruption and repression against local citizens, harm the environment, and provide little, if any, economic benefits to the poorest in both nations. The World Bank says the pipeline provides a unique opportunity to improve the development prospects of Chad by generating substantial additional fiscal revenues and foreign exchange. It also says it'll generate about $500 million for Cameroon. The bank's vote comes in the wake of recent threats by Chadian military officials to execute any citizens who oppose the project. Chadian and Cameroonian civil society groups are calling for a two-year moratorium on the project in order to allow both countries to develop a proper legal framework, establish environmental safeguards and human rights protections, and set up an independent panel of local citizens and indigenous peoples to ensure that citizens benefit from the oil extraction. We're joined right now by Robert Calderisi, spokesperson for the World Bank on Africa, and Corinna Horta, an economist at the Environmental Defense Fund. Let's begin with Robert Calderisi. Can you outline the scope, the scale of the Chad-Cameroon pipeline?
Yes. First of all, I should say that we're lending rather less money than you pointed out at this, less than $200 million. And it's not taxpayer-provided funds, but actually money we've borrowed ourselves in the international markets, which we really want to put at the disposal of these two countries. For Chad, it represents really an unparalleled opportunity to brighten its future. I mean, most people in Chad live on less than a dollar a day, and they've been waiting for 30 years to develop these oil fields in the south of the country. And the project, which will cost $3.7 billion, is going to be the largest private sector investment in Africa in the next 5 years, and almost all of it will be funded by the private companies involved.
Corinna Horta of the Environmental Defense Fund, first tell us where Chad and Cameroon are, and then can you lay out your concerns about the project?
Mm-hmm. Chad and Cameroon are in a volatile part of West and Central Africa. And basically what you have is you have findings of oil in Chad, which is a landlocked country. And in order to get this oil to the market, you have to build a 650-mile pipeline through the country of Cameroon. And the pipeline will cross all the major waterways in the country. It will cross fragile rainforest areas, which are the home to indigenous peoples. And it will enter the ocean in a coastal area that is still largely pristine and which is a very rich in terms of fishing resources for the local economy. The concerns that we have are multiple. They have to do with the lack of democracy in the two countries and therefore the lack of recourse of local people to do anything when they are affected by pollution, let's say from oil leaks or from oil spills, or when they are affected by not getting proper compensation for their losses of land and trees, which are essential to their livelihoods, or when they are being displaced. May I just continue by responding a little bit to what the representative of the World Bank said?
Yes, go ahead.
He kind of downplayed the World Bank's role in this project by saying, you know, these are not taxpayer-supported funds that the World Bank is using. These are, the World Bank is going to use its hard loan window for these projects, although both Chad and Cameroon are considered to be very poor countries. Hard loans means that the interest rate is very close to market interest rate. But nevertheless, these loans are supported by taxpayers. First of all, the major shareholding governments to the World Bank pay in a part of these IBRD funds into the World Bank funds. But for the rest, the money that the bank is able to raise on private capital markets for this type of lending is also backed by collateral from official, you know, public funds from all the major shareholding countries, the U.S. being the largest of it, followed by Japan and several of the European countries. In addition, the International Finance Corporation, which is the private sector branch of the World Bank, is also going to invest heavily in the project, and its investments will help trigger the investments of hundreds of millions of additional dollars from other sources, including export credit agencies such as the Exim Bank in the United States or Coface in France, as well as of private commercial banks. So, you know, the role of the bank in this project is fundamental, and the entire project, according to the oil companies led by ExxonMobil, the project would not go ahead without participation from the bank.
We're also joined on the telephone by Delphine Jarabi, who is a well-known Chadian human rights activist and lawyer, currently doing a law fellowship at the Center for International Environmental Law in Washington, D.C. Delphine Jarabi is going to be translated as she speaks French. What are your concerns about the project in Chad? The World Bank, as we've heard Robert Calderisi say, is hoping that this project will enrich the people of Chad.
Hello, I think that the project cannot have any benefit for the population, the local population in Chad, in the current conditions. Because the situation in Chad on the human rights front, from the perspective of the legal framework and the capacity for managing this project, are not ready. There's also a climate of repression right now that makes it the people cannot speak freely. And there's a general situation of insecurity in the country. With a rebellion in the north, there are pockets of rebellion in the south. And recently, people were clearly threatened vis-à-vis this situation, and particularly if they are opposed to the oil extraction.
Robert Calderisi of the World Bank, does this concern you?
Well, let's back up a little bit. I mean, the reason for the World Bank involvement in this project is close to what groups still criticizing the project are saying, which is that the two great challenges in the project are to protect the environment and also ensure that the oil money is used properly for the benefit of Chadians. We think, I didn't mean to downplay the bank's involvement by saying our share of the total financing is small. In fact, our role has been quite important and we hope positive. As a result of our involvement, the pipeline route has been changed in several areas, as a result of which only 4 square miles of forest will be affected along the entire 660-mile pipeline route. To compensate for that, two large national parks are being established in Cameroon with 500 times as much of an area, about 2,000 square miles, which will be protected. Not a single house or village will be affected along the route. There'll be a small number of families affected where the oil wells will be sunk. And with respect to the use of the money, we think, and international commentators have agreed that what the government of Chad has agreed to do on for to ensure oversight in the use of the oil revenues is unprecedented and really sets an example for how other oil projects could be developed in Africa. We agree with people who still think that there are issues of capacity and even governance, both in Chad and Cameroon. But our judgment is that particularly in Chad, which has had a very troubled history over 40 years, that there's been real progress in the last 5 years. The situation is not perfect, but it's very much in the right direction. And we also think it's wrong to lump Chad and Cameroon together with extreme cases like Nigeria, Sudan, and Zaire in the 1990s, where the World Bank shut down all of its operations because we agreed that any use of development assistance in those countries would not be productive. We think there is an opportunity to do good through this project, and we think it's an opportunity we should help Chad seize. But there are still risks, and we count on the continued involvement and oversight of people within Chad and Cameroon and also people around the world who have an interest in seeing this project succeed.
What about this issue that Delphine Drabi just raised of increased repression right now for people who speak out against the pipeline in Chad?
We have no evidence ourselves, and we have people on the ground, of increased threats to people in Chad. In fact, discussion of this project has been a training ground both in Chad and Cameroon for the involvement of civil society in public policy generally. And everybody acknowledges, including the non-government communities groups in both countries, that World Bank involvement has ensured a higher level of information and debate publicly than perhaps otherwise would have been the case. And we think this debate will and should continue as the project is implemented. There's still 4 years to go before the pipeline is in place, and that gives us and all concerned a chance to build a better information and capacity for monitoring the environmental, social, and economic impact of the project.
Delphine Drabi, what evidence do you have that there is increased repression in Chad?
Récemment, il y a les autorités militaires qui sont allées dans la région du pétrole.
Went to the region, the oil extracting region, to face the rebellion in the south and have clearly threatened the population, asking them to denounce the rebels or face execution. If they dare oppose the oil extraction project, they will face the same situation. They particularly reminded the population of what happened in 97 and 98, the whole massacres. Given the situation on the ground, it would be very, very dangerous for the people to reveal the sources of information.
Something on this?
Yes, because Robert Calderisi, the World Bank.
I've been to the project area myself, and as of July 1st, I'm going to be responsible for the bank's work in these countries. I have a personal interest in following up on these allegations, but my own sense of the conditions in southern Chad is that people are able to express themselves openly. No one we met, even the people who are most in favor of a delay of the project, were opposed to the project. It would be rather odd for any Chadian to object to having these resources developed for the good of the country. The real debate is whether people can trust this government. And there are certainly people who would like to wait until the next elections in 2 years' time to see what government there will be. And they hope it'll be a government they're more comfortable with. But the World Bank can't wait for elections to occur before proposing a project. If we think, as we do in this case, that all the safeguards that could possibly be designed are already included in the design of the project.
Well, I'd like you to hang on the line for 1 minute. Stations just have to break to identify themselves. Robert Calderisi, spokesperson for the World Bank on Africa, Corina Horta from the Environmental Defense Fund, and Delphine Jarabi, well-known Chadian human rights activist, now here in Washington, D.C., law fellow at the Center for International Environmental Law. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with the debate on the Chad-Cameroon pipeline. Again, the World Bank Board of Executive Directors will be voting today on whether to provide hundreds of millions of dollars to a consortium led by ExxonMobil and Chevron for a massive oil and pipeline project in the African countries of Chad and Cameroon. I wanted to raise the issue of these oil companies and their records, particularly Chevron. Longtime Democracy Now! Listeners know the expose that Jeremy Scahill and I did 2 years ago in Nigeria, documenting Chevron's involvement in the killing of two Nigerian environmentalists who were protesting the oil spills in an area where Chevron did work, protesting the lack of compensation to communities. And last year, I had a chance to go to the Chevron shareholder meeting, where I asked the CEO of Chevron, Ken Durr, if he would tell the Nigerian military, which Chevron admitted bringing on to sites, which was known for opening fire on people, if they, he would tell them to stop killing people on their sites. And this is what he said.
But have you officially demanded that they not shoot protesters on your site?
I don't know if we officially demanded it, but I think it goes without saying that nobody...
Will you officially demand it?
No. I mean, it's ridiculous.
That was Ken Durr saying that they would not demand the Nigerian military not open fire on protesters. He said that's ridiculous. Robert Calderisi, spokesperson for the World Bank on Africa, your response.
Well, we're not. We had no involvement in the Niger Delta, in Nigeria, so we have no direct knowledge of Chevron's involvement there. And the, and of course, the matter is in the U.S. courts at the moment. But in this case, it's the lead member of the private consortium financing the project, and the operator is ExxonMobil. Chevron and Petronas are passive partners in the project, and we think Exxon's record so far in Chad and Cameroon is quite admirable.
Let me ask Corina Horta of the Environmental Defense Fund, is this a concern of yours?
It is a great concern, and you know, Chevron, you may have reported on this, is now facing a U.S. court case. A Northern California District judge ruled a few months ago that the case can proceed against Chevron for human rights abuses committed in Nigeria. The other
specifically for the killing of these two activists.
Yes, exactly, for the killing of these Nigerian people. The other so-called passive partner is Petronas, the Malaysian oil company. Petronas is very active in the oil project in neighboring Sudan, which, according to a recent study commissioned by Canada's foreign minister, is intensifying the 17-year-old civil war in Sudan. So, you know, the oil revenues are fueling the war in Sudan. As for ExxonMobil, the admirable record that the World Bank representative talked about, we haven't seen much of it, actually. We think that any little concession that has been made so far on the project has been the result of enormous international pressure, first from non-governmental organizations, human rights organizations, environmental organizations, the churches, and then from governments. Nothing has been granted, freely, like the rerouting of the pipeline, which Mr. Calderasi mentioned previously. You know, the oil companies have not been able to come up with an oil spills response plan, really, you know, the basic document, the basic component of any environmental impact assessment for, you know, an oil project, especially for one of this type of magnitude. It was only after intense international pressure and, you know, the intervention of, you know, the U.S. government and other governments that an oil spills response plan was finally prepared at the end of last year. And still that one is rather incomplete. So, you know, we are very, very concerned about ExxonMobil's role in this project as well. And the CEO of Exxon has gone on record in the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago saying that poor countries cannot afford to protect the environment. Otherwise, they risk that, you know, investment will be taken elsewhere. So it seems that he is not recognizing, you know, for how, you know, much people in developing countries depend on their immediate environment for their livelihoods in a very, very direct fashion. And by not protecting the environment, you know, he's undermining, you know, their possibilities of survival.
It looks very much like the World Bank Board of Executive Directors will be approving this pipeline project today, just a few minutes after, perhaps, we speak. Delphine Jarabi, as a Chadian human rights activist, where do you now go from here?
I would like to come back to what Mr. Calderisi said. It must be clear that we are not opposed to the project, the oil project, but we're saying that under the current conditions, if this project goes forward, there will be no benefits for the local populations and for the Chadians in their large majority. The problems that are left that need to be resolved regard the human rights situation, the rights of the populations, the problems of compensation, the problems of the legal framework in Chad to ensure the good management of these problems. He's also said that the bank cannot wait anymore. So the question that we ask is the problem to help the populations in Chad and ensure that all the guarantees are in place so that there's a real poverty alleviation in Chad? Or is it a question of timing for the World Bank? They cannot wait for the election, for example. Then the situation is clear, and the bank is just doing whatever it wants without taking into account
Ms. Goodman?
The concerns
yes.
of the population.
Robert Calderisi of the World
Can
Bank.
I break in? Unfortunately, I have to actually go to our board meeting in 2 minutes, and I'm running late. But all I could say is that obviously we've been talking to a large number of people in Chad and Cameroon, and many community groups as well as people in the project area, and we're trying to respect all that we've heard and learned from those groups, and they will continue to be involved in implementation of the project. It's been a feature of this, the debate around this project, that we've been seeking rather than resisting the views of all concerned. And we think that the safeguards that have been introduced in the project as planned, both on the environment and on social protection and the use of the oil revenues, are going to set an example, if they're properly implemented, of how oil can be developed in poor countries. Now, the real test begins now, and we're just at the beginning of the journey on this, and we're acting on the basis of a track record of a government in Chad, which other people find too short, but we think it's a positive one, and we should be building on it rather than harking back to a more troubled past. But we're going to continue to encourage a debate about this project during the 4 years it will take to construct the pipeline. We're going to continue to want to learn how to do the project better. And we think this openness is crucial to how the project will be done, not just to how it has been prepared. I really do have to sign off, I'm afraid.
Thank you for
being with us. I welcome the chance to talk about this.
Well, thank you for being with us. Corina Horta will give you the last word, economist at Environmental Defense Fund.
Mr. Calderisi, you know, mentioned the World Bank's openness, you know, to civil society, and really that is the big point for us, that local people be given a voice in this, and they haven't. They have not, because, you know, during, you know, so-called consultation processes in the region, who the oil company representatives or bank representatives were usually accompanied by armed guards. In a country that has this type of experience, this civil war, this is enormously intimidating, and no kind of consultation was possible. The World Bank is just not yet ready to listen, it appears. It just a couple of weeks ago invited several members of civil society from Chad and Cameroon for talks at the World Bank. A majority of these people, including very high officials of the US, of the Catholic conferences of one of the countries of Cameroon, officials from Protestant organizations, all of them voiced the same concerns that Ms. Chiaribe has voiced on this program and in many things that she has published before. And, you know, still the bank has not listened. The bank is not even listening to its own literature. All the recent literature put out by the bank on how to make development effective, you know, how to make sure that, you know, funding for development is not wasted, points out that the very first things you have to do is you have to build the institutions in the countries. You have to create the capacity. And those are long-term efforts and things that need to be in place before you can, you know, go ahead with a project of this tremendous magnitude, which will affect, you know, millions of people in both countries and will affect the countries for generations to come.
I want to thank you all for being with us. Corina Horta and Delphine Driby, are there places that people can go on the web or call to find out more information and to monitor this project? Corina Horta, an economist at the Environmental Defense Fund.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a website or phone number that people can find out more information?
Yes, certainly at the website of the Center for International Environmental Law, where Ms. Chiaribe has her law fellowship at the moment. I guess it is www.centerforinternationalenvironmentallaw.com or at the website of Environmental Defense, which is www.environmentaldefense.com.
Thank you, Corina Horta and Delphine Driby, well-known Chadian human rights activists at the Center for International Environmental Law in Washington. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move now to the second major subject of today. At a dinner this past weekend in Germany, President Clinton's evening went up in smoke when German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder offered him a box of Cuban cigars. Diners at a Berlin restaurant said the president began fuming when Schroeder offered him the stogies, which a German government official brought back from a trip to Cuba last week. According to witnesses, Schroeder said, "The cigars that I'm holding in my hand come from Cuba, and thus I am holding one of Fidel's cigars in my hand that I would like to give to you." The diner said Clinton, perhaps remembering the way cigars were put to use in the Monica Lewinsky affair, looked irritated, and then, remembering protocol, smiled politely. Well, that's not what we're going to talk about today. President Clinton did end a four-nation European tour yesterday, which included Portugal, Russia, the Ukraine, and Germany. While in Germany, Clinton met with the country's former chancellor, Helmut Kohl, who has been mired in a financial scandal which exploded last year after Kohl admitted accepting close to $1 million in donations from sources he refused to name. Well, our guest today says this scandal reaches back to right after World War II, when the U.S. placed Nazis, Hitler Youth, and Third Reich veterans in positions of power in West Germany. Martin Lee joins us from California, expert on the ultra-right and author of the book The Beast Reawakens. He recently wrote an article online at intellectualcapital.com called The CIA's Neo-Nazis. Tell us about the history of this neo-Nazi connection. Martin Lay.
Well, it turns out today that, you know, the neo-Nazi movement in Germany is growing, and some of the elder statesmen of that movement, including one particular figure named Friedhelm Busse, has a long history and career with neo-Nazi and ultra-right-wing groups in Germany. And if you look back years ago, you find he also at one point worked with the Central Intelligence Agency. This is back in the early 1950s. Friedhelm Busse was a member of a group called the Bunddeutscher Jugend, the German Youth Organization, which was an elite CIA-trained paramilitary organization that was composed largely of former Hitler youth and SS personnel and German military veterans in West Germany. And this group was formed by the CIA basically to engage in anti-communist activities. And it was part of a larger policy that involved restoring Third Reich veterans back into positions of power in German society. And this also included within the espionage establishment in Germany. One key figure here was General Reinhard Gehlen, who was Hitler's chief anti-Soviet spy during World War II. And because of his expertise about the Soviet Union, the U.S. government decided to employ Gehlen after World War II to continue spying on the Soviets, but now instead of doing it for Hitler, he would do it for the CIA. And it was part of that, it was in the context of that framework, that some of the key figures in the neo-Nazi scene today first worked with the CIA back years ago.
What, at this point, is the CIA neo-Nazi connection to the whole scandal of the chancellor and his mentor?
Well, this is interesting because it does also relate to the figure of General Gehlen and his network that the CIA employed as an anti-communist spy operation after World War II. See, the Kohl scandal is essentially an influence peddling scandal. Former Chancellor Kohl, when he first began his political career back in the 1970s, had a very close relationship with German big business, particularly the chemical and and the pharmaceutical industries. And his mentor within the big business community in Germany was a man named Fritz Ries. He was a German industrialist who literally made a killing during World War II, during the Third Reich, from profiting from slave labor at Auschwitz. He profited from the Aryanization of Jewish properties during the 1930s, essentially basically benefited from property stolen from Jewish people in Germany. And this person was well set up after World War II. Rather than being punished, he was allowed to continue and prosper by the U.S. government, which was more interested in creating a strong bulwark in West Germany against communism than in bringing war criminals to justice oftentimes. So this Fritz Ries ended up becoming Helmut Kohl's political patron when Kohl got involved initially in German politics in the middle 1970s. Eventually he became chancellor. He was the leader of the Christian Democratic Union, the conservative political party there for a while. What's interesting is that Fritz Ries's legal advisor, one of his legal advisors, was a man named Dr. Eberhard Taubert, who also had close links to the Hitler regime. Taubert was one of Goebbels' propaganda ministry minions. He was also a judge on the People's Tribunal during the Hitler years that hand down death sentences for crimes such as telling an anti-Hitler joke or for Germans sleeping with a Jewish person, this kind of thing. And Fritz Ries employed Taubert as his political advisor, and Taubert also went through a period where he worked with this Gehlen organization spying for the CIA and in terms of the anti-communist politics that were happening during the Cold War.
Hmm. And so now we bring it back to today. What happened on May Day?
Well, on May Day, what you had was demonstrations in several German cities organized by one of the leading neo-Nazi parties in Germany today called the National Democratic Party. It's the most extreme of all the far-right parties in Germany. And they tried to basically encroach on sort of left-wing turf by holding what they claim would be pro-worker demonstrations in various cities in Germany on May Day. In fact, this happened in many different European countries. Ultra-right-wing groups held demonstrations on May Day. In Berlin, the demonstration was addressed by this former CIA asset, Friedhelm Busse, who is now a leading figure within the neo-Nazi scene in Germany. Of course, course, when the CIA employed Brucey years ago, they did not intend for him to emerge as a leader of organizations that were vociferous in their hatred of the United States. So what really is an example of kind of the blowback phenomenon, where it entails unintended consequences of covert operations conducted by the U.S. government, particularly the CIA, that are kept secret from the U.S. public, that end up sort of blowing up in the U.S. face and boomeranging. And this is really what happened with a lot of employment of these Nazis, recruitment of Nazis by the CIA after World War II.
Martin Lee, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, I want to also ask you about the connections between Busey, who's head of the National Democratic Party, Germany's most radical political party, and Haider of Austria. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with Martin Lee in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to talk about Germany today and the neo-Nazi movement there with Martin Lee, who is the author of The Beast Reawakens, an expert on the fascist right in Europe today. You were talking about this man, Busey, head of the National Democratic Party, Germany's most radical political party. What about its connection to Haider of Austria?
I should point out that Busey is not actually the head of the party, but he's a leading figure and spokesperson for the party. Its relation to Haider is an interesting one. The National Democratic Party in Germany actually held a demonstration earlier this year on the anniversary of the Anschluss of Austria, when Hitler's Germany incorporated Austria into the Third Reich. The National Democratic Party had a demonstration basically in support of this, and they came out very strongly also in support of Jörg Haider's Freedom Party in Austria, which only a couple of months before that entered the government in Austria and is now a dominant political force in Austria. Well, there's no direct connection between the National Democratic Party today in Germany and the Freedom Party in Austria. However, the National Democratic Party has been around for a while in Germany. It actually peaked in the mid-1960s, late 1960s, when they won representation in a majority of state governments in Germany. And at that time, sort of a spin-off party, also called the National Democratic Party, was formed in Austria. And some of those figures in the Austrian version of this party ended up becoming players in the Austrian Freedom Party later on and helped Jörg Haider's rise to power. So the National Democratic Party in Germany is more overtly extreme. It's about as Nazi as you can get in Germany without crossing the legal boundaries and breaking the law. The Freedom Party in Austria is more sort of a suit-and-tie version of fascism. It tries to be much more respectable, much more careful in terms of the image it projects.
I wanted to ask you, Martin Lee, in related news headlines of the French government's attempts to prevent French Internet users from getting to Nazi websites or Nazi propaganda, your thoughts on that?
Well, it's interesting because the use of the Internet and the web by neo-Nazi groups does pose significant problems and is of strategic advantage to these groups, in particular in terms of promoting what they call the leaderless resistance strategy, which is something that has been manifested in the United States in terms of these lone wolf type of terrorists. We saw with the Olympic Park bombing in Atlanta in 1996, and even you could say the Oklahoma City bombing is a extension of that strategy. The idea is that you can post on the web messages and hateful diatribes and suggestions and hinting to people that they should take actions as they see fit against the enemy, against the government, whether it's the United States or in other countries, on certain days to coincide with certain events. This allows neo-Nazi groups to avoid getting into a situation where a particular leader will issue a specific order commanding someone to go out and undertake a specific action, which then that leader can be held liable for. So the Internet really does facilitate this strategy.
It's interesting, just on Yahoo, there's an auctioning of Nazi paraphernalia.
Yeah, that's a matter of, a lot of it is just a matter of making money for somebody, auctioning this stuff. But it does come into conflict with the laws in certain countries in Europe, which don't allow publication of Holocaust denial texts, unlike in the United States. So it does, there is a legal conflict here. And I think these kinds of legal skirmishes are going to continue to play out because we were in sort of an unprecedented situation with the Internet, and these things will continue to happen.
Back to Germany, President Clinton's visit there. What is the U.S. government saying about its past and the CIA connections to supporting the Nazis of World War II and the connected to the neo-Nazis today?
Well, very little. I mean, it's one of those examples, really glaring examples, of how the United States government refuses to own up to its own Cold War skeletons in its closet and confront them. With all the brouhaha about the United States winning the Cold War, you have this very significant chapter of history where the CIA incorporates into its bosom, in the very early going, in the late 40s, literally thousands of former Nazis, and some of them weren't so former. Some of them were really heinous war criminals. And it was all part of this sort of obsessive anti-communist orientation that was being pursued in the U.S. Foreign policy. I think that the United States doesn't really own up to the role it has played in setting the stage for the kind of scandal that unfolded in Germany that has resulted in the fall from grace of Helmut Kohl, a former chancellor, and many leaders of his party. Because basically the logic was that as long as these allies were strongly anti-communist, whether they be in West Germany or in Italy or any other country in Europe, the United States was willing to look the other way no matter how corrupt they were, as long as they, playing part of the anti-communist team. And I think that's what happened, where for so long this kind of festering corruption was allowed to continue. And in particular, in terms of the Kohl scandal, in there were certain cases where actually some of the slush fund money that Kohl was gathering from these German industrials was actually put to use to facilitate CIA covert operations. In the mid-70s, for example, there was a government in Portugal that long-time repressive right-wing military regime, Salazar, he had fallen. The colonies were, Portugal was letting go of its colonies in Angola, and there was an opportunity for real change. But the CIA and West German money secretly flowed into an electoral campaign in support of a right-wing socialist against a more progressive candidate, and eventually it's the right-wing socialist that took power. So that also relates to this scandal. This money that was sloshing around, wasn't happening just beyond Washington's interest. It played into U.S. covert operations as well.
We're hoping in a few minutes to go down to Santiago to get the latest news on the court's decision there, an appellate court to strip General Augusto Pinochet, the former dictator of Chile, of immunity from prosecution. And the tentacles of the whole Nazi movement certainly extended beyond Europe and into Latin America. Pinochet was not only involved with Chile, but the whole Operation Condor extended into Argentina as well, which was a great refuge for Nazis of the time. What is the connection? Are there connections today, Martin Lee?
Yes, I mean, going back even to the Hitler years, I mean, after the Third Reich fell, you had Nazis going to South America. It's well known. Some of these people ended up becoming advisors to military regimes in countries like Chile. There was Walter Rauf from the Third Reich, who advised the Chilean secret police. Others ended up in Bolivia, such as Klaus Barbie, another war criminal, who advised the succession of military regimes there. And I think, again, one of the legacies of the CIA's recruitment en masse of so many Nazis after the war as a part of the anti-communist foreign policy the U.S. was pursuing. One of the legacies is the death squads that emerged in Latin America, because in each of these countries you find security advisors, quote-unquote, whether it's in Argentina, Brazil, even El Salvador, other Central American countries, you find Nazis there working with the military governments in these countries. And basically, they're promoting this kind of torture mentality, torture regime. And this is one of the legacies of the CIA's involvement with Nazis after the war.
You know, in the last week, we've done an expose on Yair Klein, Israel's number one mercenary, and his involvement with training death squads, paramilitary death squads, in Colombia, his involvement in Guatemala. And I just had this picture as you were talking about the origins of death squads and Nazis, the successors to Nazis in Central America, of having Israel's number one mercenary working with Nazis is sort of an unusual picture.
Unusual and yet not so unusual. It's happened in other countries as well. Nicaragua, Israelis were involved in working with the Contras during the 1980s to fight against the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. And also you had some of the Contra leaders who were outright fascists, had lots of links that have been documented with neo-Nazi groups and neo-fascist groups around the world. So that kind of constellation, you get a strange group of bedfellows when the bottom line is anti-communism that the United States is pushing.
Well, Martin Lee, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Martin Lee is an expert on the ultra-right in Europe and author of the book The Beast Reawakens. If people want to see your work, like the article you just wrote on the CIA's neo-Nazis, where can they go on the web?
There is an interesting publication on the web called Intellectual Capital. That's one word, intellectualcapital.com. It doesn't have a particular political coloration. It's right, left, and center, but it's one venue for people to publish in, and they do serious work, so that's one place to look. Otherwise, there's the book, The Beast Reawakens.
Thank you very much for being with us, Martin Lee. And now we are going to go down to Santiago, where an appellate court yesterday stripped General Augusto Pinochet of his immunity from prosecution. The court voted 13-9 for the action. Hundreds of people marched in celebration through the streets of Santiago following the decision. Pinochet's lawyers say they'll appeal the verdict to the Supreme Court. According to an official report compiled by the civilian government that succeeded Pinochet, more than 3,000 people died or disappeared under his 17-year regime. Pinochet is reportedly awaiting the official ruling at one of his countryside residences near Santiago. We're joined now by Fabiola Letelier, who is a sister of Orlando Letelier, the former defense minister for Salvador Allende, who was assassinated, Orlando Letelier was, in 1976 in Washington, D.C., by a car bomb that was traced back to Pinochet's secret police, the DINA. Can you give us your response, Fabiola Letelier, who, by the way, is a human rights attorney in Santiago, to the court's decision yesterday?
This official court verdict was expected by thousands of people. So, because the people felt that this was a step to obtain the reparation of the thousands of Chilean people that were murdered, tortured, and assassinated during the military dictatorship. And, of course, the verdict of the court means that today in our country, every person, every citizen are in the same condition before the tribunals. So the equality of the law has been recognized by the court. Hmm. That means that the Pinochet has been taken out his immunity as a senator for life.
And so what happens next?
Next, the lawyers of Pinochet have to appeal. They have told that they are going to appeal of this verdict before the Supreme Court. they have 5 days terms to present this petition, and after that, the Supreme Court will take 2 or 3 weeks to analyze, to discuss, and then to make the final decision. But we really believe, the lawyers on human rights, that all the proof, all the elements, all the evidences that has been mentioned in the verdict of the court are so sufficient to obtain the ratification of the Supreme Court. We hope that.
He was sent back to Chile. He was not extradited to Spain because the Home Secretary in Britain, Jack Straw, said he was not mentally fit or physically fit to stand trial. What is his condition? What is your understanding of it?
You know, the different journalists, different newspapers, different magazines of the press, the Chilean press, have mentioned that Pinochet, during the last week, have received the commander-in-chief of the army to discuss the situation of Pinochet. And also, he has received the visit of all the senators and representatives of the House of Representatives, of course, of the right in our country. And also, there are a declaration of one of the sons, the Pinochet sons, that has been expressed that Pinochet is recovering. So we really believe that Pinochet is in good condition, mentally condition to face a just trial in Chile.
Do you think you'll see him in trial?
Excuse me?
Do you think you'll see him in trial?
You know,
on trial?
Of course, in my country, we have, a system, a judicial system. During the military dictatorship, they don't make a denigration of justice. But now the things have changed because, as you know, the Chilean government, the government of Frei, was the one that asked before the kingdom tribunals. They say that Pinochet was ill, was sick, and all these humanitarian reasons. Our country, the government, the civil government, in this moment is involved.
Is involved. Well, it looks like we just lost Fabiola Letelier, but we have come to the end of the show. Fabiola Letelier is the sister of Orlando Letelier, killed, it is believed, by Pinochet's secret police in Washington, D.C. in 1976, blown up along with Ronnie Moffitt by a car bomb. She is a human rights attorney in Santiago, Chile. Again, the latest news, the appellate court of Chile stripped General Augusto Pinochet of his immunity from prosecution, and we'll continue to follow the case. Tomorrow, we are hoping to do a show on DNA and the death penalty, so do stay tuned. You can write to us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Jeremy Scahill. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Matthew Finch is our engineer. Special thanks to Robert Knight and Bernard White. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Canto porque la guitarra tiene sentido.